Good evening. As everybody's settling down, I just wanted to say a few words. I want to thank you all for joining us here tonight for what I'm sure will be a very illuminating discussion. My name's Hester Westley. I'm based here in the research department at the Tate and working with a team on the gallery's newest research project, which is called Art School Educated. We're delighted to host the panel this evening, which has been organised by the Adult Programmes Department in conjunction with the P3 Ambika Gallery. And I'm sure most of you have already been there to see the fascinating exhibition, which showcases a wide range of contemporary artists as it juxtaposes current artworks with of these artists with works from their respective formative training. And a congratulations is in order to the P3 Gallery's Michael Mazier. So I don't know if Michael's in the audience somewhere, but yeah, bravo. And a big congratulations, of course, is in order to Roderick Coyne, whose vision really has played an essential role in bringing this whole project to life. So underpinning and unifying the concept for the exhibition at the P3 Gallery and the publication which accompanies it was one clear goal. It was to recognise the teaching career and contributions of Peter Cardia, who's seated just here. Each one of the 28 artists included in the exhibition is acknowledging their former teacher's efforts and commitment to expanding their views and ideas on the possibilities for art in the contemporary world. Through a campaign of pedagogic innovation in the sculpture department at St. Martin's and then at the Royal College of Art, Cardia provided successive generations of art students with a model of intellectual and artistic intrepidity as they moved forward into experimental arenas of art practice. We here at Tate are particularly delighted to host this evening's panel discussion because it gives us an opportunity to remind this audience in particular of our extensive Leverhulme-funded research project called Art School Educated, Curricular Change in UK Art Schools from 1960 to 2010. Many of you might already know about this work. Some of you might have been approached by either myself or my colleagues, asking you to share with us your personal experiences. But for others, it might be the first time you've heard about this research project. But either way, I want to take this opportunity very quickly to urge all of you who are here to fill in the sign-up cards that are circulating, and we'll collect them at the end of the evening, and this way we can keep you abreast of the work as well as upcoming events. This evening's session, I think, offers us an opportunity to consider those issues in art education that arose since the publication of the first Coldstream report in 1960. This pivotal moment has exerted an unmistakable force on art pedagogy and its impact on practice. In a sense, tonight's interest in the ongoing conversations and debates about art school education is a microcosm of this larger project that we've really embarked upon. Recognising Peter Cardia's subversion of traditional art teaching models is a thread in the complex tapestry of art historical narratives that the Art School Educated project seeks to trace. This evening's conversations, I think, only highlight the urgency of this research. After all, there have been no comprehensive histories of UK art schools in modern times. The main objectives then of this project are to research and record institutional and curriculum histories of art school, of London art schools in the post-war period. And I think this research, or we hope this research, will reveal how art school education has affected the intellectual formation and practice of contemporary artists whose work entered the Tate's collection in recent years. And other objectives include establishing sort of institutional chronologies. We hope to make major studies of the sort of London art schools and of the key players, of whom many are here tonight, and we'll certainly be recording, we hope to be recording many of you for sort of oral histories. So I'm going to stop there, but on behalf of all of us here at Tate, I want to thank our panellists, the artists and, of course, art educators, Richard Deacon, Jean Matte, Malcolm LeGrice, Peter Cardia, Richard Wentworth, and I'm personally thrilled to be able to listen in on tonight's conversation, one that will be reliably chaired by Malcolm LeGrice, artist and filmmaker, and I'm going to hand over to you on that note. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Esther. If any of you've got mobile phones and they ring, if it's for any of us up here, could you tell them we'll call them back? Thank you very much for coming. I hope none of you are intending to leave before the end, because Peter's been round and locked all the doors. Also, the end of the evening at 8 o'clock, we're due to finish at 8, there are drinks outside. So, again, if any of us go on too long and you go on too long with your questions, just remember you'll be eating into drinking time, which is not a good idea. So I think we'll get started. It's customary, I think, when you're introducing somebody to try and invent something nice to say about them. Well, I've been racking my brains a bit about this with Peter. But the truth is, I consider myself extremely fortunate that I started my teaching career while I was actually still at the Slade in my final postgraduate year. I was very fortunate, I think, to find myself in St. Martin's almost without knowing what I was there for, and finding myself working with Peter. I've always, since then, had an incredible respect for Peter as an educator, as an influence on students, but also as an influence on me as a teacher. I've always had, until tonight anyway, a very friendly relationship with Peter that I hope will continue for many years yet. But I think it's difficult to overestimate the importance of what Peter has done, always in a way seeming to keep in the background, never promoting himself as an artist or as an educator, always in the background, and always causing immense trouble, which is wonderful. And you know you're doing something right when people are opposing you. So I think that's enough from me. I'm going to hand over to Peter Cardia. Peter.
Thank you, Malcolm, for those remarks. I'm most grateful. For me, it's been an extremely interesting experience to see the work of the many artists who are showing at the Mbeka P3 Gallery, all of whom I had contact with when they were students. Before we begin our discussion, I think it's important that we need to register that we are able to have these discussions and to experience all the work in the exhibition because of the efforts of Roderick Coyne, who came up with the initial idea for the exhibition and has worked unceasingly in organizing it. Without Roderick's efforts and ideas about the structure it should have, this exhibition would not have taken place. Others who have undertaken crucial roles include Michael Mazier, the curator of the Ambika P3 Gallery, and Caroline, who engaged with many of the organizational problems for me. I have dealt at greater length in the catalogue with a good deal of what I will attempt to refer to this evening. This has to be brief, because as Malcolm has said, there are other members of the panel to speak, and after that we need time for discussion. If one spends most of one's time teaching art, one has to give attention to the nature of the subject that one is concerned with and the context within which it is produced and reacted to. A requirement of this kind has very wide ramifications and leads to a concern with many aspects of experience and behavioural interaction. I think that it could be said that in our everyday behaviour, we exhibit a desire for a predictable and ordered world. This desire involving a tendency to ignore factors that operate against this notion. It is not difficult to understand how this tendency developed. If we consider our perception, it presents us with information concerning both the spaces we are located in and the various items also present. On this information, our reading of space and object allows us to move effectively and safely in the space and around the objects. We store this type of reading so that it can be utilized again and again. We might call it conceptual indexing. The reactivation of these concepts is, of course, continual. And because they're used in this way, they become dominant, often making a reading in circumstances where they are inappropriate. Fortunately, our behaviour is not totally determined in this way. From time to time, we find ourselves with intense experiences, sometimes from some aspect of the world that surrounds us, and sometimes originating in our own psyche. Often, these experiences affect us in a deep and powerful way, and we long for them to be permanent so that they could be relived. This strong desire to be able to return at will to these areas of experience is the motivation for the attempt to produce convincing records of what took place. With this ambition comes the requirement to continually increase the ability to produce adequate depictions of various types of experience. When we speak in this way, we are, of course, concerning ourselves with the nature and purpose of art. Recalling the powerful incentive in our mental processes to continually strive to recognize, to conceptually index what is before us, the question is, as we enter the world of art, depicting intense experiences, how do we avoid what we produce becoming subject to this tendency? At this point, as I have said on many occasions, we need to take a journey back in history. And in the Critique of Judgment by Kant, we come across some notions that are extremely helpful. Kant says, by aesthetic idea, I mean that representation of the imagination that induces much thought, but without the possibility of any definite thought whatever, i.e. concept, being adequate to it, and which language can never get on level terms with and render completely intelligible. In effect, Kant is saying that in a work of art, none of its various reference in the powerful group that surround the work must be allowed to become dominant. The experience of the work involves a process in which, when registering a particular referent, one moves towards it with the belief that this is the subject of the work. However, As this movement is made from within the circle, another demand is made, then another and another. The structure of the work prevents any single reference being used and conceptually indexed. One is not allowed to relax into the belief that one knows precisely the subject matter of the work. The genuine work of art is experienced as the continual movement across a range of very specific and demanding reference, none of which is allowed to become dominant. In the work of art, one is confronted with an assembly, a bonding of factors that are only present in very particular and intense experiences. This assembly process must itself also be subject to a requirement that it does not provide an opportunity for the components to be readily identified. To attempt to give some clarity to this point that I'm trying to make, we need to go back. This time, it is recent history. My reference is the work of Cézanne. Cézanne's work is unique, not only in the manner in which he emphasizes the continual movement between the visual gestalts that we become aware of if we decide to look reflectively at objects and the space surrounding us. Cézanne's paintings require that we look at them intently and register the vigorous demands that the continual assembly and disassembly of the gestalt structures make on as our eyes move over the depicted landscape. Exciting and demanding as this experience is, my reason for referring to Cézanne was the question of the assembly of very divergent factors, these being achieved without the components becoming easily identified. In addition to what has been already referred to, Cézanne was also concerned with the actual physicality of things, a sense of touch and weight. Blending with his acute visual sensibility, there was also an awareness of the haptic, and his later pictures blend these factors together without one of them becoming dominant. His work places significant demands on all those concerned with art. As we look back through history, it becomes evident that at all times we should be concerned not with fashion and publicity, but with the intricate factors embedded in all genuine artworks. What I've tried to deal with today necessarily has to be brief and sketchy. We are looking forward to what other members of the group have to say and then move on to this discussion.
Okay, now I'm going to ask Jean Mathey if I can, a short introduction. Jean has a wonderful piece in the exhibition and in the book that forms the catalogue that in a very curious way manages to combine a kind of theoretical reflection with an engagement that is through the senses and which is both aesthetic and intellectual and has a philosophical as well as a theoretical base. Now, I've had contact with Jean over a very long time, as a teacher and since listening to her at conferences and so on. She's always driven me completely crazy by asking questions which I feel like I should know the answer to, but never do. And I've come to the conclusion that there's two reasons for it. One is she's much better read than I am. That's number one. And number two, she's probably a lot smarter than me. So I'm going to let her. Jean, it's over to you.
Thank you.
When thinking about the conjuncture of pedagogy and art, I want to adhere to the thought experiments that include Peter Cardier's, that seek to expose and make sense of the potential for radical innovation, revolution, invention, transfiguration, and revivification in the radical pedagogy of art practice in every situation, where the stake is newness that punches holes in the archaeology of knowledge. I want to adhere to thought experiments that try to describe and affirm what helps to preserve and encourage an artist's subjective fidelity to their desire or truth process. I take the foundational condition of pedagogy and art practice to be an ethics. Here are three important ethical prescriptions to preserve and encourage an artist and an art teacher's subjective fidelity. Don't give ground on your desire. Don't give up, continue. I can't go on, I will go on. The thought experiments for radical innovation in art and pedagogy, including Peter Cardier's thought experiments, provide a topology for a rearticulation of ethics. These topological thinkers distinguish a rearticulated ethics from the current of opinion that incessantly evokes an ethical ideology. This ethical ideology is identified by these thinkers as a severe symptom of renunciation of the one thing that distinguishes the human species from the predatory living organisms that they also are, and that is the capacity to enter into the composition and becoming of desiring singularity, and the logic of being true to a person, a cause, an ideal, and in the case of art and pedagogy, a practice. The topology for an ethics of radical innovation rigorously thinks the logic of the place of being and what being adheres to in the processes of becoming, transformed, transfigured, revivified, reinvented, through the conjuncture of the technologies for transformation in the practices of pedagogy and art. This topology organizes the adherence of being and its neighborhoods, boundaries, and so on around two poles. One of the poles being can ethically adhere to in the topology is organized around neoliberal, pragmatic, democratic materialist neighborhoods that sway toward the nihilism of economic necessity. This is the realm of goods, professional, domestic, aesthetic, the realm of traditional morality and ideology that serves the virtues and position of the master and power. This pole is also the realm of the pleasure principle, the demand for happiness, civilization, and the bourgeois dream that builds a corset of correctness that cleans up art's act, making desire wait. Ideological ethics and pedagogy acquiesces in the absolute domination of the individual by the status quo, acquiesces in the established interests of those who dominate and govern the situation, acquiesces in the whole apparatus of its intellectual, moral, and political justification. This pole is the ordinary realm of established interests and differences, of approved knowledges that serve to name, recognize, and place as consolidated identities. This realm of knowledge is static, objective, and structured in dominance. The sum total of these structurings, namings, classifications, divisions, and distributions are the state of the situation. The indetermination of domination by the state ensures conformity or obedience from classified, divided members of the situation. Adherence to this pole is pedagogy's acquiescence and participation in knowledge that supports the structuring of archaeologies and geographies of domination. The other pole in the topology of an ethics of innovation is organized around radical desire motivated by no good, beyond the place of restraint and beyond the least suffering principle. This is the exceptional realm of singular innovations that persist only through the militant proclamations of those rare individuals who constitute themselves as subjects of desire and truth, as the militants of their cause. The ethical destiny of these thought experiments are important for questions about the conjuncture of art and pedagogy. The ethical destiny of these thought experiments are important for questions about the conjuncture of art and pedagogy. Anamorphotically reverse the place of adherence and ethical invariance of being in becomings of art practice, reversing from the pole of goods in the topology to the pole of radical desire. This is instantiated in the disquietudes of encounters and becomings in art practice. Radical eventful pedagogy emerges as imminent to an anamorphotic reversal from the established realm of knowledge structured in dominance, with a seamless geometric ordering of space and time, normality, reversed to a topological creation of emptiness, supplementary excess, or oddness that is the void of the situation from the perspective of those who dominate. Eventual pedagogy emerges in this reversal and is raised on the slope of the difference between normality and oddness, between reality and the real, between the cultural good object and the drives with their fundamental bad character, between the symbolic order and the real emergence of the undead, indestructible object of life that is deprived of support in the symbolic order. What emerges in the reversal of eventual pedagogy is supplementary excess that can only be gained access to through subtraction by undeceiving and disintoxicating psychical goods and knowledge. This is a reversal from the secure emplacement of the subject in normative space to the place of supplementary excess, a place where something comes from nothing, where the subject is cut loose from psychosocial moorings, experiencing loss of bearings. In the art studio experience, in the encounter between teacher and student, there is an attempt to make something appear that was not there before. This is to pull a rabbit from the hat to incarnate supplementary excess that is foreclosed by normative pedagogy that conforms to the business model of a nihilism of economic necessity. Making something appear that was not there before is to pull the topological operator of intimate exteriority from the constellation, teacher, student, and the process of the work of art. This is to put into circulation, in the studio encounter, the supplement of excess in the constellation. This constellation includes the emergent work, the emergent singularities of both teacher and student that arise imminently through the process of the encounter. This supplementary excess is intimate to the process of the studio encounter, but exterior to identity, consciousness, or knowledge. It is possessed by neither the teacher nor the student, who are both cut free from psychosocial moorings in the encounter. With this in mind, the locked room stops the subject, artist, student, teacher from taking flight from the terror of uncertain meaning and can save an artist from avoiding the subjective test at this extreme limit. The locked room supports staying with disquietude, out of which creation emerges. These thought experiments of radical pedagogy as an eventual ethic of innovation are the apparatus of the science of causing to know, subordinated to being seized and displaced by flashes of supplementary excess or exposure to foreign bodies that are strangers within the constellation previously foreclosed. The maxim proclaimed is a paradox. Keep going. Continue to be the someone, a human animal among others, which nevertheless finds itself seized and displaced by the eventual process. Continue to be the active part of that subject that you have happened to become. These foundational thought experiments construct a compass for taking ethical bearings, for finding an ethical orientation, and are here put in service for pedagogy as part of the generic field of art, to provide a compass for our time of profound historical change and global transformation that we are living through, where the predicament of contemporary art is complex and the epistemological foundation, that is its condition, is being reconfigured. The compass allocates precise status in the topological configuration to the coordinates of supplementary excess, precise status as polar star, line of sight, and measure for judgment in navigation. Something must happen for there to be something new. Even in our personal lives, there must be an encounter. There must be something that cannot be calculated, predicted, or managed. There must be a break based only on chance. As the artist Alan Stocker says, you don't have a chance unless you take one. This is the revolutionary throw of the dice. These thought experiments understand the dignity of the art process as technology for transformation, to be a constructive power. The problem for the art teacher and art student is to allow the gift of something that cannot be calculated, predicted, or managed, to allow for a rupture based on the gift of chance, a defense lifted, a limit crossed, a supplementary flash of innovation exposed and encountered. This is to make an ethical act, to take a chance on an encounter with a flash of supplementary excess from any point within the sovereignty of the global market and the generic field of art, so as to open scenarios of global and aesthetic destabilizations that break the enemy's ability to isolate, exploit, and eliminate. This is asymmetric resistance in which desiring singularities find free spaces, holes and folds for transformations through their ability to circulate, navigate, and contaminate. Disintoxication of psychical goods and knowledge involves an act with its core in emptiness, involves taking up a place of being incontestably a subject who does not know. This is a non-derisory crossing of a limit that involves risk. This is a subjective test that can be taken in the generic field of art, and in this field the test is singular in its occasion, location and vehicle, universal in its import and address. Grace or chance is the condition for staking something intimate from a position of radical unknowing. This staking of an extimacy has dynamic value that can renew creative potential. The ethical stake of a non-pacificatory catharsis is the imminent emergence of the singular subject, with universal import and address, taking a running jump in the dark beyond the discourse of correctness, duty, and restraint, a leap that takes time, that wakes time to life, an act of destruction that allows for a new beginning. Eventful pedagogy prepares the student artist so that they do not flinch at inevitable betrayals. The exceptional subject in the ordinary person is a potential someone who can be betrayed with impunity. Not everyone can achieve this. The exceptional subject who can self-authorize and has independence can take the vote in her own law. She can keep her own reference points beyond what is recognized by the other, and in this way she can hold on to her claims and be betrayed with impunity. This is what constitutes the difference between the exceptional subject and the ordinary person, and this is mysterious. For the ordinary person, the betrayal that almost always occurs sends her back to the economy and service of goods, but with the proviso that she will never again find that factor which restores a sense of direction to that service. On the path of a new emergence, the subject pays the price of a radical subjective destitution, emerging out of joint, excluded from the order of things. The alternative is domestication, to be anaesthetized, put to sleep, to commit psychical suicide, to submit to the nihilism of economic necessity. The path of desire and truth is difficult by definition. It goes against the grain of tradition and the natural elaboration of time. It presumes the ability to identify and resist various forms of corruption, interest and exhaustion that beset fidelity. The path is vulnerable to various forms of erosion at every moment. The desiring singularity does not betray her way through lack of discernment. She discerns true from false events and does not confuse them. She employs animal obstinacy, powers of endurance and courage to support a difficult fidelity, and has the necessary restraint to resist hubris. She does not force the unnameable by naming everything. She does not confuse subjective truth with objective knowledge. Eventful pedagogy supports and encourages subjects who bear the efforts and demands of a process of truth and desire, those who unlink chains subordinate to and organized around the good or goods to relink the chains harnessed to desire or truth. These topologies provide strategies for David to take on the many faces of Goliath. They provide the coordinates for an orientation to meet the historical determinations of the time we are living through: global markets, multinational power, the weakening of the power of the nation state, the instability of the borders of the nation state, the new forms of juridical practice, the inmixing of first, second, and third world, the post-colonial constellation, flows of migration, nomadicy, and miscegenation, new cultural creolizations, the insufficiency of the concept of multiculturalism, and new forms of technology. The maxim of eventual pedagogy subordinates these determinations to the topological coordinates of fidelity to radical desire and eventual truth processes in the different generic registers, politics, science, love, and art, and the way they intertwine in practice. Now I will read, I'm coming to the end of the paper. I will now read the last three theses out of the 15 in Alan Badiou, The French Philosophers, Thought Experiment on Contemporary Art. So thesis number 13. Today, art can only be made from the starting point of that which, as far as empire is concerned, doesn't exist. Through its abstraction, art renders this inexistence visible. This is what governs the formal principle of every art, the effort to render visible to everyone that which for empire, and so by extension for everyone, though from a different point of view, doesn't exist. Thesis number 14. Since it is sure of its ability to control the entire domain of the visible and the audible via the laws governing commercial circulation and democratic communication, empire no longer censures anything. All art and all thought is ruined when we accept this permission to consume, to communicate, and to enjoy. We should become the pitiless censors of ourselves. Thesis number 15. It is better to do nothing than to contribute to the invention of formal ways of rendering visible that which empire already recognizes as existent. Now let's end this with questions I pose to myself as an artist and an art teacher. Is your art practice an invitation to the revelation of your desire? Or do you aspire to happiness and a situation of individual comfort? Do you take art to be the guarantor of the bourgeois dream? Does your art practice change the primitiveness of your relationship to the good, the moral good, and to goods, and its economy and service? Do you keep on the side of the least suffering principle, moderateness and temperateness, the good that keeps you from the you save from the void of supplementary excess? Do you take in your sublimations the first half-stereo step toward what dwells within the constellations, intimacy, supplementary excess, the first half-stereo step in your praxis towards your topological coordinates of concrete particularity, pathology, locality, alterity, excess? Thank you.
Sure, there's a lot of questions which will be coming from that at the end of our little discussion. Hester, is she here? Yes.
Can I speak to the lectern?
Yes.
Hester, right,
okay,
fine. I find it quite difficult.
All right. I've got to introduce you
sorry.
First.
Sorry, I'll jump up and down.
Don't think you'd get away with that. Richard Deacon, I discovered this evening something I guess I should have known was that we were both at the same secondary school in Plymouth, which I had
not
to leave.
Not at the same time.
Not at the same time. which of us was there first, do you think? but I had to leave there because I thought of it as a culture-free zone. And I don't know whether Richard felt that. He's certainly tried to improve the cultural aspect of Plymouth. There's a wonderful, very large piece of sculpture in Plymouth that Richard has done. He told me tonight that it needs painting. So I promised him that I'll go and paint it next time I'm there. Richard, can just a little bit about your work. I've always been fascinated by the way that your work always encourages me to be able to find a kind of unifying gestalt, but always defies my ability to do it. And I see this as very close to what Peter was talking about in his understanding of the work of Cézanne. Now, I don't expect you to answer that or agree with it or disagree with it, but certainly for me, that ability to maintain the contradiction in the work and to keep the spectator, the person who's looking at it, engaged in the active relationship with the work, without the work actually having to change. I mean, as a filmmaker, obviously I have that kind of element of time, and the work changes as it goes along. But your work doesn't change because it's a solid piece of work, and yet it can contain that developing contradiction for the spectator.
Yeah.
Now you can say what you like.
That's a factor.
I'm going to give you some snapshots. 3 days, in fact. September 22nd, 1969. On arrival at St. Martin's, the incoming sculpture students were directed to the A2 studio. One end of this large and at that time empty studio was closed off by a barrier of wooden screens. In the center of this screen wall was a locked door with a notice pinned to it saying, "Project area. Knock before entering." Sculpture students from all 3 years of the diploma course assembled in the room. Those returning talking, those new sitting or standing, mostly silent. At about 10:15, two men came into the studio, both wearing name badges, Garth Evans and Gareth Jones. The first year students were told to return to the studio at 11:20. At the appointed time, the new students gathered in the studio. Garth Evans and Gareth Jones reappeared. Gareth held a small box of name badges. He picked these out one at a time, reading the written name aloud and giving it to the responding student. All having received badges, Garth read from a piece of paper that he held in his hand, an introduction to the project. In this statement, he emphasized that the project would be demanding and requires self-discipline on the part of the students to make it successful. His hand shook as he read. The door to the project area was then unlocked. Garth and Gareth entered, followed, one at a time, by the students. As each entered, they were handed from piles either side of the door a cube of about 20-inch side wrapped in brown paper. The project area was bare of furniture, save for notices pinned at various points to the walls and saying, "No drawing or writing materials to be used. Punctuality is essential. No verbal communication between students. Verbal communication is allowed between an individual student and member of staff. The project area will be open 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock, 11:20 to 1 o'clock. 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock, 3:20 to 4:30. Pieces of card pinned at various points to the floor each contained the name of an individual student. I took my cube, placed it by the card containing my name, and sat down on it. This was the first day of the project that has become known by the name of the year of the locked room. I think that's a bad name. You'll notice that it doesn't say the project area is going to be locked. It says the project area will be open. At no point is closure mentioned in those instructions. This is the week of the 15th to the 19th of October, 1970. So on returning to St. Martin's at the start of the second year, I didn't really know what I wanted to do or how I wanted to do it. But I did think that what I wanted to do involved manipulating material of some way, though I didn't know what material it was that I wanted to manipulate. So I set about making a material and constructing a place in which that material could be manipulated with some kind of equipment. I also began thinking about the kinds of roles that people play when they make art, the kinds of roles that they occupy, and came up with a notion of a performer, an assistant, an observer, as being a sort of triangle of characters that somehow are always engaged when art is being made or being considered. And I wrote about this at some length, and this is the account of the period in which, parts of the period in which I was undertaking a performance using that material. So this is starting on the 15th of October. I've necessarily cut out some days. So, performance. In the morning of the first day, I rolled the material into the centre of the performance area, folded it in half, and bound it with wire. There was no assistant. In the morning of the second day, I invited Peter Atkins to attend as observer to my performer. The following account is based on his description. Parcel of material bound with wire in the centre of the performance area. Cut square aperture into parcel, through cloth, through cardboard, into clay. Make a small package of clay, tie it with cloth. Walk with package to the wall end, nail it to the ground. Unclip string, turn around. Clip string back onto belt, walk to parcel. Remove with pliers long strip of cloth and of cardboard from the aperture. Make a small package of cardboard, tie it with cloth. Unclip string, turn around, clip string back onto belt, walk with package to wall end, nail it to the ground. Unclip string, turn around, clip string back onto belt, walk to parcel, enlarge aperture. Make a small package of clay and cardboard, tie it with cloth. Unclip string, turn around, clip string back onto belt, walk with package to wall end, nail it to the ground. Unclip string, turn around, clip string back onto belt. Walk to parcel, sit astride it, saw section through end. Unclip string, turn around, clip string back onto belt. Pick up cut section, walk with it to the wall end and place it on the ground. Unclip string, turn around, clip string back onto belt. Walk to parcel, stand looking at it. Remake parcel with wire. Cut wire on top of parcel. Saw parcel through centre. There was no assistant. Now I'm missing, I've left out some days. In the morning of the fifth day, Ted was the performer and Ian the assistant. With Peter Atkins, I attended as an observer. The following account is based on a consideration of photographs taken by Ian in his capacity as assistant. 1. Standing in the middle of the area, facing wall and parcel of material bound round with wire. 2. Undone parcel at the wall end, two lines of material running along the edges of the area, a pathway between them. At wall end, facing wall, bending forward from hips, left arm down, hand in material, right arm at side. 3. Two lines of material, mainly cardboard and polythene, spread out along area. 4. And this is photograph number 4. And you can see Peter and myself standing at the back there. At wall end, walking towards door between lines of material, shoulders hunched, head down, elbows back, arms hanging down, left foot forward, right leg back, heel off the ground. 5. At wall end, turning towards door, body bent, straightening, right shoulder down, arms in front of body, hands holding a large piece of the material, left leg back, bent at the knee, foot flat on the ground. 6. At wall end, running towards door, holding a piece of the material in right hand, body crouched, right leg forward, bent at the knee, foot off the ground, left arm forward, swinging across body, fist clenched, left leg back, straight, heel off the ground. I continued to work with the same material for most of either with that material or with the material that I'd gained by using it as a means of exchange for most of the second year. It never achieved a final form, but it was a process of some continuity. We'll get there in the end. Here we are. In October 1974, I went to the Royal College, a department called Environmental Media, where Peter was head of department. Although he continued teaching in the sculpture school at the Royal College at the time. So this is a letter from Peter dated October 24th, 1975, and sent to Bruce Janan, Peter Venn, Caroline Cardia, Tony Cragg, students in the sculpture school, and myself, a student in environmental media. Dear Richard, it's my inclination to use some of my teaching time in the sculpture school for seminars. As a result of a discussion with Caroline and with Bruce, it occurred to me that a useful way to consider work would be to look at it from two positions, either as belonging essentially to a structure which for convenience could be labeled personal, or as belonging to something which might be thought of as the public domain of sculpture. Naturally, I regard these two modes as conveniences, and it would seem to me to be useful to attempt to articulate the way in which, for example, work, while instancing projected possibilities, the disclosure being made for the individual by a comparison between current and previous work, with such a viewing determined as the mode personal utilizes sculpture terms dropped to it from the public domain. I'm referring to an unsuccessful mix which needs sorting out. I have reservations about the term personal. If you're interested in taking part in these discussions, please let my secretary know as soon as possible. Friday the 31st of October at 10:30 will be the first occasion for the undertaking. Tony Cragg was the first of the group up, and this was the work that Tony presented on that occasion. This is a very good work. Rich in many ways. And our discussions around the work, which elicited from all of us as the rules of the seminar or the our agreement involved us writing up our discussions, our thoughts or our perceptions of the discussions afterwards. Peter Cardia, discussion held on Friday, October 31st, 1975. Various possible ways of approaching the notion public domain. In the case of Cézanne, either as address to the problem of figure or landscape painting, or is concerned with perceptual process as structure and replacing object as cohering factor. What were the factors in the world of Cézanne? In the case of Tony Cragg's work, characteristics, ordinary debris containing dated periodicals, are possibilities for public domain, since they are factors shareable by those with common environment and are apparently subject to no qualification in the work. They have objective characteristics. Size and shape of the particular piece of work becomes personal. Ways in which public and personal interrelate. Tony's model, hourglass configuration, wide-based, the context, narrow neck, some factors or strands from the context brought together in the deliberate act of sculpture making. The product becomes a new factor in a context which is represented by the widened top area. Tony Cragg's work is personal. View one, piling and storing of special materials, own past work. View two, past work piled with debris, attention switches to debris. View three, fucking walk over that. I'm not satisfied with the small attempts of last year. That's a lot of stuff for me to hump around. Thin layer over everything. The space became the form. I spend a lot of time drifting around. I made them deliberately small, not small enough to go in your pocket, but not to stand in front of you. Metaphors, difficulties in conducting a discourse. Metaphors and models in use need to be amplified. Use implies the responsibility to amplify, reservation about extensive verbal discourse with consequent unwillingness to adumbrate a model or metaphor mean that the tendency to use a metaphor should be relinquished. And these were my notes from the same seminar. In relation to the proposed terms of the seminars, it is worthwhile to consider the ways in which Tony's expression, fucking walk on that then, is diffused by descriptions of the work as minimal and anti-form. In considering the public domain of sculpture, the implication of what was said on Friday seemed to tend towards its description in terms of things in the air. A corollary being that it is only with a reflexive glance that we're able to recognize work as belonging to that domain. I assume such a formulation not intended to imply the operation of a haphazard or luck of the draw system in the work. I couldn't help myself. Such elements being characteristic of a personal approach. And it elicited from Tony, who actually doesn't write all that much. And I'm not going to read all of what Tony wrote, but it elicited from Tony a rather wonderful description of his notion of the relationship between his idea of himself, the personal, and other people's idea of himself, the public. The second direction, although not realized at the time, was probably more significant in relationship to our initial concern. During the conversation, I described various aspects of my piece of work's privateness, how I collected the materials, what it means to me with regard to my total body of work, my continuing efforts, etc. I realize that though the work stood in a public situation, I'm almost incapable of seeing its publicness, as I know too much of its privateness. When I started to consider privateness and publicness along these lines, an analogy sprang to mind. My impression of what I look like is based on information derived from looking in mirrors and on what I can see directly of myself. But on occasion, I have been caught between two mirrors, or have seen a film of myself, and I suddenly see someone I hardly know, realizing with further surprise that that's the person everybody else knows as me. That is my publicness. For me, this defines the two different types of viewpoint, publicness and privateness, and I find it directly applicable to sculpture. If this description is accurate, it seems to raise certain problems with regards to Peter Venn's definition of publicness, in which the work has to aspire to publicness. As I believe one has extreme difficulty in being able to see the publicness of one's own work, it requires someone not fully conversant with its privateness to reflect it for you from their viewpoint. So those are three days in my experience of being taught by Peter Cardia. Although obviously he wasn't mentioned on that first day in St. Martin's, it became clear to us students that the four members of staff, Peter Harvey is the one that isn't mentioned here, were all equally involved and equally committed to that project. It's a mark of Peter's remarkable teaching ability that he can go from the radicalism of that first-year project to the patience to stand on a cold roof in St. Martin's twice in 1 week to engaging with a group of postgraduate students on a level of equality produce a discussion about their work, which still resounds in my head. Thank you.
Tribute, I think, also to Peter, that we have three artists sitting here, each very different from the other, but all taking some kind of base from the kind of open philosophical position, or closed philosophical position, that Peter adopted. Richard's work's always fascinated me by the way that he can take and make an intervention in what is almost a kind of normal daily environment for us, and do something which twists our perception, shifts our perception of that event, and but at the same time allows us to see how that is working in relationship to our normal and everyday lives, and using something often quite small to crack open something of our perception of what constitutes our environment and our life. Do you want to? Are you going to stand up, or are you?
I feel like I ought to lie down, actually.
I was wondering.
I'm very uncomfortable with lessons. I don't have any notes. And in a way, I think I really respect Richard for being that assiduous, that he makes the notes, and he's kept the notes, and he can find the notes. I'm sure I have kept the notes, but I don't know where they are. I think the thing I wanted to... Obviously, tonight is rehearsed in different ways, and it's going to join up however it joins up, but am I...
Is it one of these moments? Is that all right? Okay, can you hear me? Sorry. I think the thing I wanted to honour tonight was eventuality, actually. And there were several things that Richard said which really strike me. I thought the first thing that completely got me was Richard saying, I sat down. And there's no explanation of how he sat down at all. And of course I went, oh, I suppose there was a chair, because that's sitting down. So already you're in a kind of space all the way through Richard's piece where the problem of description and giving a faithful account is wavering all the time. And, you know, this is whatever we are, 130, 40, 50 people, all pressing on that information with some archival photographs. And it's not an accident that I want to remind you that people sometimes had hair, sometimes they had long hair, and you're an aging population, all of you, even the young. So I wanted to do something which was about the fact that we're really bad at internalizing historical space. We might be able to articulate certain things, but the fact that so much happens in parallel and constantly is something that the human seems to be quite poor at dealing with. There's a way in which we speak about things that have happened that are terribly lame. So an opportunity like tonight to try and retrieve a moment with Peter is very hard. And I can say that when I walked in tonight, admittedly slightly late, but not too late, Peter smiled, and there's a excuse me, there's a sort of strangeness about very small things that humans exchange, which is attached to recognition. And my period at Royal College was precedes Richard Deacon's by a couple of years. In fact, strange to see that letter from St. Martin's with a date on it, and I sort of know roughly what I would have been doing at that time. And I think Peter's, I don't know whether it's the right word, but there was a kind of quizzicalness. He has a kind of quizzicalness, which is extremely demanding. And I think if I describe a school which was in some, I think it's safe to say, quite pretty buildings, very eccentric buildings on Queensgate, adjacent to the film school. So the people that you would meet were mostly filmmakers. You didn't, unless you made an effort, you didn't meet anybody else. And very much organized around what I would call, you know, very much boys' things, very bish, bash, bosh. No power tools, almost nothing that plugged in. Quite, I don't want to say it was primitive, but it was a much, it was definitely a kind of fingertips space. And hugely informed by its immediate past. And its immediate past meant that there was, there were people who could model like a dream. There were people who could just pick up a piece of clay and make a shape, you know, just would come out of them. Not many, but enough. Who you, I now realise, oh, I suppose they could have been part of, I think Rodin had 50 people working for him. Of course, they would have missed that space. But that was a very powerful currency. The floors were trodden with plaster and clay, and it was in everything. And I think that was the dominant culture. Carving had sort of ceased, but the big furniture of carving was lying around, big, beefy bankers and things. Very much the kind of thing that somebody like Barry Flanagan's very articulate, was very articulate about. And for me, Peter was a sort of measuring stick. He would... I sort of fantasize you came on Thursdays, but maybe it wasn't Thursdays, but there was that thing about being young, not very wayward, because in fact there wasn't very much to be wayward about, because there was nothing to spend any money on. People were poor. It's a, this is a Valahita world of, and Ascot, you know, so I think it's important to reclaim that stuff, not to romanticise it, but because I was living at the Elephant and Castle and I watched the Haygate estate being built, which is now about to be demolished, and I can feel my optimism of watching it being built and my optimism of all the demolition that preceded it. So these are sort of quite big urban events, and they certainly went into my experience of being a, you know, young Londoner. But certainly there was this thing about going to this school, which was very curious to know how you were ever employed, actually. I, you know, how the regimes work, who's making what permission to who. It was run by Bernard Meadows, who had worked for Henry Moore. And I think there must have been some kind of quite honorific thing between you, because I remember you once saying something that was slightly out of order, because remember, this is a deferential time. This is still... You know, people are still wearing greatcoats from Lawrence Corner. It's a funny period where there's a resistance to what had gone before, talking about the men. But actually, the before is, was very, very present. And I remember Peter saying something that was somehow argumentative with Bernard Meadows, and I thought, wow, you know, all the teachers don't agree. I think that's a very important moment when you're very young and you start to realise that these are distinct opinions, distinct values. But the thing that Peter provided was this absolute ordered, I think Richard described it very well, you know, that incredibly attentive and very demanding. And I think as you get older, one of the most frightening things of all, completely remembering what had been said the week before or sometimes a fortnight before and being able to bring it up. which is a very, very salutary thing when you're in much more complex, elaborate atmospheres, which, of course, you were not. I wasn't discussing the Haygate estate with Peter. And I think it's a very, you know, this time now is so pliant. You know, time is not disposable at all. You know, everyone is multiply engaged, and it's very febrile, and it's sort of extraordinary to try and sort of pull that up. There are a few people here who know what I'm talking about, and there are some people going, is he describing the First World War? I'm actually describing, you know, something which is actually retrievable, but is just so unbelievably differently structured. And there's one person here who, just to end on a kind of local note, there's one person here who had inside knowledge of the Lycée on Cromwell Road at that time, and said they had to import yogurt.
I had the easy job tonight because all the people were going to do the speaking and bring out the ideas, and I didn't have to do anything very much. And I did feel that I would be obliged to make some kind of summary, but I'm damned if I can. I think it's impossible in this environment to even begin to try and bring together the kind of range of discussion that we've had. I think that the one of the interesting things for me is this. This kind of extremely rigorous confrontation with what you don't know from Peter, you know, that he, instead of taking that attitude, which was fairly prevalent in the 60s, that anything goes, and it's all a kind of liberal mishmash, Peter was never that, you know, it was always rigorous, and I think the idea that it was critical was... people were focused in onto this kind of territory of their own uncertainty, but I think was Peter's uncertainty as well. I mean, I think that was the great thing for me, that Peter was not selling an art style. Peter was developing an approach to how you dealt with not knowing, you know, and I think that's, for me, a really wonderful. And out of that, people could develop new directions which were completely unpredictable, that they didn't exist before, and so I think that was fine. We were going to have some kind of cross-discussion within the panel, but I think that we've got to the point where it's probably better to open it to the floor. The rules of the game, you can ask questions, but if you want to make a statement, that's fine. I don't think you have to form it as a question. If you want to ask a question or respond to any of the speakers, please do. But if you want to make a statement yourself about how you see the Cardia experiment and what came out of it in relationship to the present situation of how to deal with the problem of teaching art, please do. One other rule is that if you're going to speak, there's a microphone. Please ask for the microphone. And if you can, remember also to give your name. The questions are being recorded. I hope that the answers aren't. I'm looking.
I'd like to say something, actually.
Oh, please do. There we go. Right.
I did meet many other people in my course through art colleges. I began listing them before I came here tonight, and felt that those people should be honored as well. So at Somerset College of Art, Dave McFarlane, Blanche Croydon, John Hilliard, Rose Van Kelsey, Ian Brakewell, Peter Robinson, and Jack Coulthard were all people that I enjoyed talking to. At St. Martin's, apart from the four I've mentioned. There was also Mike Williams, Ed Taney, David McLagan, Roy Derniat, and Robert Bell, who were all tutors in the complementary studies department. And at the Royal College, Yehuda Safran, John Lifton, Hans Brill, the wonderful librarian at Royal College, and Tony Raines. And when I was did some art history at Chelsea, again it was Yehuda, Nick Wadley, and Chris Yetton. So many people go together to make up an artist, as a student, I also went out to look for people. Peter is an exceptional teacher, but I did encounter many others who formed my view.
I'm looking for burning questions. There we have this microphone this side. Could you say your name, please?
Is it on?
Yep.
Yes. My name is Nigel Slight, and I was one of Peter's students back in 1964, so it probably makes me one of the oldest here, I think. I wanted to ask a question which really, it does come from Peter's discussions with me, and it was something he said about never giving up on the latest thought that's come into your mind. And I wondered how I would explain the nihilism of economic necessity to somebody who'd been on benefit for 2 years.
It's your question, Peter.
It is a question to me.
could you re-ask the question? Could you just re-say the question?
Explain the nihilism of economic necessity to somebody who'd been on benefit for 2 years.
I mean, is the question about the attitude of the teaching staff to the difficulties of the student?
It was a sentence that came up during Anne Mathis' delivery.
Yes.
So.
Well, I don't know how to respond to... I don't really know what you're asking me, because I talked about economic nihilism and the business model in relation to a kind of neoliberal context and the kinds of effects that has on the experience of teaching, because the experience of teaching that I had in environmental media, and when environmental media closed down, many of us were forced to go underground. It was kind of the winter years, because so many other things other than environmental media aligned with what environmental media stood for were closed down in the late 80s. And what it was that environmental media sort of represented was this non-restricted experience where you didn't have to quantify production. I mean, I had most of my years in environmental media, I talked with Stuart Marshall, Peter, and Yehuda Safran, and I hardly made anything. And there was no pressure on me. I wasn't made to feel that I was not being productive. Thinking, talking, exchanging transactionally with other students' work was considered to be productive. And this is not possible any longer because of this economic business model in art schools. It's not possible in the same way.
Jean, what I thought was interesting about environmental media was that actually I understood where the department had come from and its kind of history, but the fact was it was a department with a name that really didn't mean very much, although it had certain equipment. The interesting thing about being a student there was that you had no subject to hide within, or to kind of, so you had to decide, as it were, what it was you were doing in a kind of categorical reasoning, as well, so that whereas a student in the sculpture school somehow had the notion that they had this sort of historical, whereas in environmental media you weren't an environmental mediaist. You kind of worked out somehow what it was you were.
And it was all right not to know.
Yeah, it was all right not to know.
For long
exactly.
periods.
Mm. Yeah. And I agree with you. I think the loss of those at a kind of postgraduate level, the loss of those, there was also Department X at the Slade, and the loss of those sort of ill-defined departments was a big big loss to.
Because can I just come back on that? I worked at in Goldsmiths after environmental media, finishing it in environmental media. I had a job for 9 years in fine art at Goldsmiths, and it was during this new stage, neoliberal kind of stage, and I'm just thinking of something Jean Fisher said on this platform not that long ago, that what was coming out of Goldsmiths at that time was a sort of ageist, conservative nationalist project, you know, the YBA project. And a lot of students came to Goldsmiths wanting returns, immediate returns on investment. They wanted to be a proper name. They wanted to be in circulation as a proper name immediately. They wanted professional goods and bourgeois goods, and they wanted it now. And this was, you know, this was very, very, very different to the whole ethic of environmental media.
I mean, in some ways,
I'm not sure I agree with that.
Have we got a question?
Have we got one of those students?
No.
Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Yeah. Yep.
Mine is very much, it's more of a contribution, really. We're living at a time when there has perhaps never been as many wars in the world simultaneously across different zones. When the reconfiguring of political power has taken on a very violent and to some extent destructive presence, and I'm chiefly thinking of the remapping post 2001 of both economic and cultural power. And we're also living at a time when it couldn't be more lucrative for you to invest your money in contemporary art. Indeed, you could, one could make a very safe investment in some forms of contemporary art, and so one could take one's money out of a bank and to make better money from forms of contemporary art. So in that sort of climate, and you've mentioned the nihilism point there, in that sort of climate, is it an accident, or is it not surprising that students expect that immediate return? And is it, I mean, our generation, for example, who haven't experienced a moment like the early 60s, or even let alone 68, are we, in a sense, nostalgic about a past that we've never experienced, or are we waiting, or are some of us simply biding our time and should perhaps even think about getting out of art? Indeed, I've thought about that. So yeah, it's just very much for you to sort of think about as a comment.
I mean, let's carry
Hello?
That debate on.
Hello?
Yeah. Yep.
I was interested in the idea that Jean was proposing, that you were free from psychosocial moorings. And I'm not sure I'm convinced by that sentence. So I was wondering if you could elaborate on that. Because I personally don't believe that you can ever really escape yourself in anything that you do. And working through your work, you kind of naturally see your own perspective and the glasses you wear to view the world that you're in through your engagement with the things that you find around you.
I'll just use a sort of an extreme example to make the point. I mean, trauma, an encounter with trauma is too much to be organized as an experience. So time and space kind of collapse. And many artists try and, through fiction, touch some kind of traumatic. They make a kind of future anterior loop and try to deal with something traumatic. I'm thinking of the Atlas Group, for example.
I'm very conscious now that we are moving into the drinking time.
I just want to say something about, in response to the man over there, and partly in disagreement with Jean's point. When Damien set up Freeze, what was great about it was that it looked like it was supposed to look. It was a simulacrum of a successful show constructed by a bunch of recent graduates with no pedigree, no nothing. And they claimed the ground that they occupied by taking it. They weren't given it. They took it. So their whatever their expectations, they didn't wait for someone to come along and give it to them. They made themselves into what they were by making things that looked like the things they thought they should look like. It was an extraordinary reflexive notion of art making.
Yeah. But can I just
I need to close. Yeah. I know what Hester is going to tell us.
I think it's very important to remember there was a lot more money then. I was on a full grant in the 70s.
Yeah.
People were in short life housing, hard to let. You know, it's easy sometimes to be completely dismissive of these people who seem to be grubbing around for a sale of their work when they really are paying, you know, by work, their own labour often until 3 in the morning in bars and try teaching people nowadays and keeping actually something going, which is about why certain people went into art maybe before the YBA, which was not to make money. I mean, I remember a time when people always thought they would be the ones who would go into advertising. And I think it's just the economics is incredibly important to remember. And also, giving the YBA credit is, you know, great as well, but what about punk? That also came out and did this, not waiting to be asked, you know. So that if you're not trained, Portsmouth Synthonia, you know, don't wait to be trained, get on with it. Just don't, you know, look like it's a huge laugh, because there were serious, also political issues in both punk and possibly the YBA, that could be argued. But I just think when we talk a lot about bourgeois values embodied in the present day youth and art, it's very, very important to remember all that kind of, you know, support that once existed. And I was a student in the 70s, then in the 90s, now, you know, trying to sort of actually encourage people in that way that's been described so beautifully. Keep going with doubt, with uncertainty, in very uncertain times. But, you know, sometimes just those terms, bourgeois, or petty bourgeois, are just kind of unhelpful.
What Hester is going to tell us is that this is the first of a series of discussions which will go on about teaching and and pedagogy and general around art. And the, as usual, we've just entered the next point of the debate at the very end of this one. So, Hester, I know what you're going to say, so please say it. And
please do fill in those forms so we can be in touch with you all and keep you abreast of the upcoming events around these discussions and art school education generally. We'll carry on the conversation with the drinks, yeah. But can we just say another thank you to Malcolm and our panellists?
And thank you all.
Can I just say something before you all go? I'm very relieved to hear that there are more discussions, because I think the points that were raised at the end of this session about the economics of the position and the way in which the art practice, genuine art practice, relates to the economic structure which is in existence at the current time, that's a fundamental issue, and I think it really requires
another conference,
yeah. At least 2 hours.
At least 2 hours.
We need some of those bulky bankers that Richard mentioned.